The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So again, good morning, everyone. My name is Kyoko Katayama, and I'm doing the talk in Mark's absence, as many of us fill in while he's away. The title of my talk this morning is in the form of question. What has to die to meet hate and fear with love? And what does death got to do with meeting hate and fear with love? So I hope this is just going to be an inquiry together, just ask together a bunch of questions. And in the process of it, I'm going to tell three stories that make most of us really uncomfortable. So that's the bad news. You might want to brace yourself. This may not be a feel-good talk. But we can learn to lean into our discomfort, to see where we close down. So a good news is that when we learn to tolerate discomfort for the sake of learning and with a wise intention, we may realize that an experience of discomfort is a doorway, a threshold. On the other side of the threshold, there is a release of self-centeredness that is a cause of much suffering. So one of the things that makes most people uncomfortable is the topic of death. A couple of weeks ago, a friend soberly exclaimed, "You teach a class on death? It's so morbid." I do teach a class on befriending death, not just once, but I spend 6 weeks a year teaching the class here at Common Ground. And the class will be starting soon, in about 10 days. Then my friend mumbled something under her breath. So I said, "Pardon?" And she said, she looked at me in my eyes. She said, "I think it takes a lot of courage." And I nodded, returning her gaze with tenderness and recognition. You see, she has been grieving the death of her beloved mother from cancer. And as much as she wanted to avoid the topic of death, she couldn't help but to think about it, albeit with trepidation and uncomfortable feelings of regret. Morbid. I hear the word many times, but I was curious to know the exact meaning of it. The dictionary said, "Morbid, given to or characterized by unwholesome thoughts or feelings." Another dictionary said, "Appealing to an abnormal and unhealthy interest in disturbing and unpleasant subjects like death and disease." And that's what I talk about a lot. Death is an unhealthy, unwholesome, abnormal, disturbing, and unpleasant subject. Wow. So reflection on death is the contemporary West's, is associated with all these terrible characteristics. No wonder people are uncomfortable, frightened. Do you think the Buddha was morbid when he encouraged his followers to reflect on death not just once, but often? One time, he encountered three monks. He asked the first monk, "How many times do you think about death?" And the first monk answered, "I think about death every day." And the Buddha said, "Too little. How about you?" And he turned to the second one. And the second one said, "Oh, I think about death with every bite of food." "Mm-mm, not enough," he said. "And you?" He turned to the third one, who replied, "I think about death with every inhale and every exhale." And he said, "Very good." Isn't it interesting that to reflect on death in our culture is considered unwholesome, abnormal, and disturbing, whereas in Buddhism, it's not only wholesome, it's also death is considered as a great teacher that reveals to us the nature of our existence, characterized by impermanence, no self, and inevitability of suffering. But the teaching doesn't end there. There's so many, many teachings. How precious this life is. We don't appreciate it if it just goes on forever and ever. So whether you think about death or not, one thing for certain is that none of us escapes death. And then we cringe reflexively on that thought. Death is a normal part of life, an inevitable consequence of having taken this birth. It doesn't just happen to old people or sick people, babies, teenagers, strong-looking young adults, healthy middle-aged people. They also die. And you probably know many of them in your own life. Rich or poor, risk taker or conservative, there's no exception. So in this way, death itself is nothing abnormal. Ram Dass said, "Death is absolutely safe." Well, easy to say. We can even see theoretically, death is a consequence of taking birth and revealing the truth of impermanence. But death is something that happened to other people, right? Just 3 weeks ago, 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when a car slammed into a crowd of counter-protesters at the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville. Do you think she, Heather, got up that morning thinking that she might be dead that afternoon? I wonder what her last thought might have been. I wonder where she is now. They said she died doing what she loved, to fight for democracy, to stop hatred and bigotry. I pray that her transition was without suffering and in peace and in love, the values she held highly while she was alive. I love teaching Befriending Death class because the more I reflect on how fleeting this life is, how little control we have over how and when we die, the more I see, it's not just seeing, I feel, I know in my body how precious and fleeting this life is. Reflecting on our mortality is a sure way, I know, to come alive in the moment, appreciating the beauty and goodness in us and around us, even in the midst of hardship or conflict or in pain. It compels me to engage with my life in intimate and wholehearted way. The reflection inspires me to ask often what my priorities are given my finite time on earth. What really matters to me? How true it is that the only thing I truly own are my actions, just like the five remembrances we've chanted this morning earlier. It makes me pay close attention to my intentions from which my actions spring forth. When we hear a news of death in the media or in our life, let's notice how the mind wants to just skim over it or go a little numb. Or outrage. Sometimes heart just breaks with unbearable pain. Let's take a moment when that happens to register our reaction to the news of death. When we can, let's say the name of the dead. A human being's life has ended, and they have their own experience of dying that we cannot fathom. We only wish ease of transition for the dead. We wish the survivors well. We wish to comfort them and offer a prayer of healing and peace. And we need to act on these impulses of our heart, our good heart. You know, it doesn't take long. We can say those things in 1 minute. It took me a minute to say this. And we can all spare a minute of reflection when we hear about death. And if not 1 minute, 10 seconds. Let time stop one moment and let in the truth of existence that we all share in common and make loving wish for them and for ourselves. So how's everybody doing? How uncomfortable are you? Are we doing all right? Well, there's more to come. There's a story from Jataka Tale that makes me pretty uncomfortable, but also it makes me feel really drawn to it with curiosity, partly because it's a story of an extreme, like many other stories in Jataka Tales are. So, do you know about Jataka Tales? No. So Jataka is a compilation of hundreds of stories from India and Buddhist Asia that tell the story of the previous lives of Gautama Buddha, the Buddha to be. And sometimes the Buddha to be is called the Bodhisattva. And the story of the Bodhisattva comes in human and animal forms. And in the previous lives, he or she may appear as a king, as an outcast, a god, an elephant. And each story, still imperfect, yet inspiring Buddha to be, manifest some kind of virtue. So they are a kind of a Buddhist morality tales, and they are often told to children. So here's a story. This particular story is well known in Mahayana Buddhism, and this does not appear in Pali Jataka tale. So, once the Bodhisattva was born in a respectable family of the scholars, he was bright and he mastered all the teachings given to him. But he became disillusioned with the worldly life. So he renounced a life of comfort and prestige for the spiritual life of an ascetic. And he had followers eventually. So one day, rambling about the meditation caves, accompanied by Ajita, one of his disciples, he saw below the mountain an exhausted and hungry tigress. The tigress could hardly walk to hunt for her own food, and she was about to eat one of her own cubs that she had just given birth to. And the Bodhisattva exclaimed, "Hunger causes the tigress to violate her own love's law." And he was shaken by compassion in seeing the suffering of his fellow creature. And he decided to offer right there and then himself to save the tiger and her cubs. So the Bodhisattva sent Ajita away in search of food for the tigress, knowing very well that he would not find it. And no sooner than Ajita left the sight, the Bodhisattva jumped from the precipice above the tigress. The noise of the fall caught the attention of the hungry tigress, who in no time scooped his limp body and with her cubs feasted on it. When Ajita returned and did not find his teacher in the same place, of course he looked around. And he was surprised to see that the tigress no longer seemed hungry, and her cubs also happily frolicking around. And soon he was shocked to see the blood-stained robe of his teacher scattered about. So he knew then that his teacher had offered his body to feed the hungry tigress and protected her young as an act of great generosity and compassion. And of course, Ajita realized why the teacher sent him away. So what comes up for you in listening to this story? What does a story supposed to teach us? What do you think was the Bodhisattva's last thought as she hit the ground? Certain Mahayana teachers say that the Bodhisattva was like Christ, dying to save all sentient beings and creatures. In fact, this theme of dying to save sentient beings appear many, many times in Jataka tales. It is the Bodhisattva ideal. And certain other teachers say the moral of the story is that the Bodhisattva was indeed imperfect to engage in such an extreme act of self-sacrifice. He had to be reborn again and again before he was born as a Buddha to discover the middle way. Yet another interpretation is that this is a symbolic story of compassion and generosity. It has nothing to do with self-sacrifice of the body, giving freely and wholeheartedly without looking back, without a concern for self-interest. And I wonder if there are other interpretations to this story. And my mind wandered off to this idea that we daily eat the offering of other lives in the form of plants, animals, insects, fish, just as a tigress would have died if she didn't eat. We would perish without eating other life to nourish us. Some scientists say even plants have sentience. They process information. They sleep. They remember. And they communicate. They signal to each other. Death is involved in every act of eating in order for us to live. But we don't think about it. It makes us uncomfortable. And then I wonder if the tigress who fed on the bodhisattva became herself an enlightened creature, because the bodhisattva literally became the body of the tigress. I wonder if the bodhisattva's fall is a metaphor of birth, life, and death. When we take birth, it's like jumping off the cliff, and we don't know how tall the cliff is or what awaits us at the bottom. And we have fleeting time to realize what this life is really about and make the best of it. Well, there is an interesting twist to this story that I heard recently from my friend Tomoe-san, a widow of Zen Master Katagiri Roshi. Do you know Katagiri Roshi? Yeah, a lot of people know. He founded the Minnesota Zen Center many years ago. She said she heard this version more than 70 years ago in Sunday school. Sunday school? I rolled my eyes. And she said, you know, the Buddhist temple Sunday school. Oh, yeah, in Japan. And Tomoe-san is herself a Buddhist scholar, but she has not been able to find any written source for this story, this version. So she told me from her faint memory this, that atop a high cliff, the bodhisattva was listening to a wise creature recite a Dharma poem to her. Then she saw the hungry tigress below. She said, I need to go. So the creature stopped reciting. And the bodhisattva said, oh, please don't stop. Please continue. So the creature returned to reciting the poem as the bodhisattva jumped off the cliff. And Tomoe-san said, the poem is Iroha. Iroha? I said. Well, I know Iroha. Every Japanese child learns Iroha. It contains each of the 50 Japanese alphabet without repeating the same letter once. So therefore, Iroha is used like ABC, you know, as an ordering of list. We memorize it without understanding the meaning of it. So I still remember most of it. It goes like this. Iro wa nioe do chirinuru o waga yo dare so tsune naramu ui no okuyama kyo koete asaki yume miji yoi mo sezu. So I have to kind of like really go into it and find the meaning of it, you know, 60 years after I learned it. It goes, so the meaning is, Iro wa nioe do chirinuru o, while the scent of a flower still lingers in the air, its petals have already scattered. No one escapes the truth of impermanence. Arriving today at the far end of the deep mountain of the fleeting world, without intoxicated by its shallow dreams. In other words, not distracted by myriad dramas of this samsaric world, let's awaken to truth, the Dhamma. In mid-air, the Bodhisattva heard the poem, and she was enlightened. She became liberated from suffering and the constraints of the body. There was no fear, only freedom and love. What is the moral of this version? The Bodhisattva wasted no time in gaining insight into the nature of existence. Upon awakening to the Dhamma, she was free of suffering, even as she offered herself to the tigress with ease and joy. I tell the story as an invitation for each of us to reflect on the meaning of this story. What it teaches you is different according to your interpretation, and there is no right answer. And the meaning will change as we change. The meditation master Uttejaniya said, "Wisdom never believes, it always investigates." So, there's more. The third uncomfortable story is something that happened to me. Recently, I picked up a call from someone I never spoke with on the phone. It was a mother of one of my young friends that I've helped some time ago. My young friend was in trouble, and she had to appear in court. So I went there to support her. I saw my friend's mother in the courtroom. As the mother was leaving, she glared at me and yelled mean, disrespectful things, blaming me for her daughter's trouble and everything else. She didn't give me a chance to engage in the conversation. She just left me there, stunned and hurt. That was my last encounter with that woman. When the phone rang and I saw her name on the caller ID, I didn't want to answer, but I was afraid something might have happened to my friend and I should know. So I picked up the phone with a lot of trepidation. I was afraid of so many things, afraid for my friend and afraid for myself. I knew from my friend that her mother is a committed Trump supporter and a fundamentalist Christian. The group of people I have steered clear of in the past. And it's really true, I lack practice in how to engage with people who seem so opposite of me. I probably don't even share the same language. So different from my values, my beliefs, my lifestyle. And besides, I am white. I am not white. Maybe I wish I was white. I don't know. I am not white. And of course, she is. When my bubble burst at the last election, I made a commitment to not put myself back in the bubble again. In Buddhist terms, it means to not succumb to habitual and reactive pattern of thinking and acting, and to practice opening to what is, radically opening to what is, while not turning a blind eye to suffering in the world. But the image of the white supremacist marching with so much hatred and the car crashing into the counter demonstrators killing Heather Heyer, these powerful images evoked fear and outrage. It was these images and feelings that arose as I picked up the phone and said, "Hello." The woman on the other end of the line was actually surprised to hear my voice. She said she pushed the wrong button. So we exchanged polite greetings, and she asked me how I was doing. And she said she had a lot of health issues, but now she's doing pretty well. And I expressed my gladness for it. And the whole time, I waited for a chance to end the conversation while it was civil. Then she said her daughter was turning 40 in a few weeks, and she plans on having a special party for her. Will you come? I didn't know what to say. I fudged and ended the phone call. Then I asked myself, would I go to her house? Never was my reactive response. I wanted to close down, keep a safe distance. But my heart asked me, what about your commitment to not reactively close your heart? About your aspiration to keep your heart open to all things, all beings? Can I meet fear with tenderness? Can I meet hate with love? These are the teachings of the Christ, Dr. Martin Luther King, and of course the Buddha, and all our teachers. Hatred does not cease by hatred. Love alone releases hatred. This is the eternal law. It was written in the Dhammapada. Gospel of Matthew says, love your enemy and pray for them. But I'm not Dr. King. I'm not Buddha or Dalai Lama. I'm not Thich Nhat Hanh. Can I, this ordinary person, love what I fear? Can I love seeming enemy? In the safety of my quiet room, I put myself in the woman's shoe as a human being, not as an object of my fear, not as someone who hurt me. She's a mother just like me. I could see she really loves her daughter and wishes for her to be happy. And when I recognized that, I relaxed. To meet the mother of my friend, subduing my reactivity and fear with equanimity and honest, honest friendliness. Some things in me have to die. And here is a list of what have to die. My need to uphold my beliefs and my way of viewing the world, even my lifestyle, as the right way or the better way. The illusion that if I didn't speak up, I was abandoning my beliefs, my identity, or my lifestyle. A belief that I would be safe from hurt if I silently ignore and dismiss people who seem to disagree with me on every front. I need to change her so I feel good and safe in the world. Those are the things that have to die. I sincerely wish that I would allow those things to die. It's not easy. And each thing on this list is worth taking time to examine. And each one should be several Dharma talk, don't you think? And of course, we don't have time today. I got just a couple minutes left. I resolved to accept her invitation if she followed up. And in fact, I kind of come around and became curious as to what would unfold. What of love and fear would I learn? And I feel almost excited. I would be disappointed. Maybe not. I don't know if she didn't invite me. What an opportunity to really practice entering the heart of discomfort. Meet my fears with love and others' fear and hatred with love. Remembering the goodness in that woman as well as in me, despite the vast difference in ways that goodness expresses itself. Beyond the right doing and wrongdoing, there is a field where we can meet, Rumi said. Well, then I got a little scared. What if I get hurt in the process? Is the practice of meeting fear and hate with love worth dying for? Like Dr. Martin Luther King said. Or is it like I'm naively jumping off the cliff to feed the tigress without searching for alternative to save the tigress? And here's a question for all of us. What will happen to the world, to our children and their children, if we didn't practice meeting hate with love? If we allow hate and fear to become a norm of our society. So I'm ending the talk with these open questions. It's an invitation to keep on turning towards what really matters to you, to me, to make our life, our practice, worthwhile. So, what's your comfort level right now? So we have a few minutes for comments, discussions.
Yeah, when you consider that we eat lives with plants and animals. Also, our fear of suffering causes us to put too much into medical testing and animal medical testing. There's millions of animals that die. They're raised in cages and just are tortured and die just because we are afraid to suffer a little bit. Oh, this infection might not heal if they didn't study enough about this type of an infection or something like that. Millions of animals die just because we're afraid to feel a little uncomfortable, or we're afraid to deal with the realities, like the five truths that we're not free from illness. We're going to get sick if we don't die first. So it's a fact of life. And why should millions and millions of animals die because of our fear of that fact? I just think it's so wrong. It's something that's bothered me ever since I learned about it as a child, and I've never been able to do anything about it, and it seems like nobody even wants to look at it. All the doctors and everybody knows it's going on, and they refuse to care. And I think it's a sign of how terribly, terribly, terribly sick our society is. And you know, and like you said, I maybe jumping at this time in front of that tiger, I don't care if it eats me. I mean, this society is so sick. Thank you.
Well, you said there's nothing you can do. I think there's nothing we can do to immediately change. But we can always remember them. Remember the animals. Yeah, but we know that many animals die. Remember that. And we can care. We can say, I care about you. Yes, that's something we can do. It's not nothing. It counts. Yeah. Okay.
There seems to be, a lot of people that say, I want to die, or I'd rather, die than, captured by the police or something, or, I don't think life's worth living, so what? Can you elaborate more on what you mean by befriending death? Because that's what it sounds a lot like to me.
What? I didn't understand your question. More on...
Befriending death, because that's what it sounds a lot like to me.
Come to my class. I don't think I can... So, in a way, this talk this morning is an elaboration on that. It's to not forget that this life is very impermanent, and that how do we want to, and we don't know when and how we are going to die. So then how do we want to live the life that I have right now in this minute?
Kyoko, thank you so much for the talk. The five remembrances are lovely because they can be a daily or with each breath practice. And I really appreciated you added another layer today, not only that the physical death, but also what do I have to give up to have an open heart and to be present, my judgment, my wanting it my way, my being uncomfortable. And those are such really wonderful reminders as we go into the day. So thank you so much for that.
She wanted to.
Thank you, Kyoko, my teacher and friend. Today I sit with gratitude for having cancer, because every day I live, I get to let more things die. And you really articulated that really well for me today. Thank you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you touched on with that last story is a really interesting thing that I see going on around us with our current struggle, and it's as some of the darker aspects of our society are given voice, there's a tendency for a lot of people to think that the answer is to condemn or to shut down, and it's such a difficult thing not to. But I definitely think that it's important for all of us to reflect on that you don't balance a scale by tilting it really far in the other way, and I think the onus is really on us, like, to be the bigger person and to as best we can sort out the difference between physical danger and discomfort, and I don't know, I guess it's not really a question or a comment, just an appreciation for how hard of a line that is to find and to walk, but how important I think it is that we never resign ourselves to pretending that it's a simple matter of good and evil.
Thank you. Yeah.
Like the teacher that offered himself to the tiger, I think of an exit plan. My exit plan would be the Stone Arch Bridge with a brick around my body. Would you support that? That's my question. But my comment before that is the beginning. Thanks for your talk. Thanks for all of your supportive energies. Thanks for all the leaves, as they all were contained and responsive in many ways. One comment is the beginning, as you spoke about how often to think about that death. You gave a few examples. What was really touching for me was between the words, but there was a point when you said the one monk that spoke every breath. Well, I think that every breath is a good time to think of that. When I exhale, there's death. When I inhale, there's life.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, the last one.
Thank you for the wonderful talk. The reason I'm speaking is because I just did exactly what you didn't do. There was a family gathering where there is a like an invisible wall that you can see between the liberals and the people who support Trump or that side. And the last time I went last year, it was so uncomfortable. And there seemed to be no way to integrate. I just didn't go because it was just too painful. Not that they were there, but that there was just this wall. There was no communication. But halfway through the time when I would have gone, I realized, and I think you actually reinforced this, I realized I could have just sat down with someone and said, so what do you do the rest of the year when I don't see you? And I realized I didn't have to talk about politics or I didn't have to talk about what divides us. I could just ask a normal question like you might ask in a coffee shop or something. And it was really revelatory to me because I was so focused on the difference, and I realized I didn't have to do that to communicate. In fact, that it would be a terrible way to start a conversation. So thank you.
Yes, when we notice that, not only we notice the difference, I think consciously or unconsciously, we want to change them. And that actually continues the divide and the wall. And it, mind, ego doesn't like that. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.